This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Our first stories are coming to us from Newsweek magazine, dated November 28, 2025. And this first story feels a little like the movie Terminator, but it's real life and it's today. Ultimate Warrior? The team behind this android expects humanoid robots to be weaponized for military use. A demo at Newsweek's headquarters showed there is still a ways to go. Meet Phantom MK1, an imposing humanoid robot designed to transform battlefields, the moon, and even Mars, and it may already be taking jobs near you. A 5'9", 176-pound steel and plastic android that can walk nearly 4 miles per hour is manufactured by Foundation, a well-funded San Francisco-based startup with lofty ambitions for 2026 and beyond. These include ongoing discussions with the Department of War, yes, it's no longer called Department of Defense, for the robots to augment or take over perilous tasks performed by soldiers, company officials told Newsweek during a private demonstration in New York City. Essentially, the general principle is we want them to be able to do anything humans do. That's step one. Foundation CEO and co-founder Sanket Pathak said in early November. The ultimate goal would be sending these robots out upwards on the moon and Mars to build infrastructure, defend the infrastructure, maintain the infrastructure, and go places that humans cannot really go. The vast skill set needed by Phantom to accomplish those otherworldly objectives can be learned via various defense-related applications, including maintaining and refueling aircraft or breaching barriers in combat zones, Pathak says. If you actually do defense use cases, you build infrastructure, you maintain it, and you safeguard it, he said. So we think it's a very important thing to be able to do it if what we really want to do is expand the scope and scale of consciousness and send humanity to a different planet. A Department of War official told Newsweek, in an evolving and dynamic threat environment, the War Department embraces autonomous systems. From drones to robotics, innovative autonomous technology will be developed and deployed to strengthen the capabilities of the warfighter. Autonomous systems are the future of the battlefield, and whether these systems are used to deliver medical supplies or to increase operational efficiency, the department is actively exploring these new frontiers. Pathak, 35, is the former CEO of failed fintech firm Synapse, which went bankrupt last year amid a dispute with partners that led to more than 100,000 customers losing access to hundreds of millions of dollars in deposits. He launched Foundation last year with Tribe Capital co-founder Arjun Sethi, 42, and Mike LeBlanc, a 39-year-old former Marine, aligned with the company's willingness to potentially weaponize Phantom. We were very adamant that we wanted to build something that could eventually go to space and do those kinds of things, Pathak explained. So Department of Defense use cases made absolute sense to us. We didn't know how quickly we would work on weaponized use cases versus just logistics and things like that. The sense of urgency for possible weaponization of humanoid robots is definitely increasing, according to Pathak. Because it turns out China, Russia, and other people are pursuing it, and the U.S. doesn't want to be behind, right? He continued. But the goal here is to put these robots in situations, in places that are either too dangerous for humans or just too tedious and laborious. Pathak said he doesn't expect future iterations of Phantom to be outfitted with weapons, but acknowledged the possibility amid Foundation's long-range goal to produce a robot that mimics and outperforms humans in virtually any task. One of our big design principles is the robot should be capable of interacting with the world the way humans do, which includes using tools that humans use to be able to do the tasks that they need to do, Pathak said. Sometimes that might mean it's going to use a drill. Sometimes it might mean it's going to use a gun. LeBlanc, who previously ran autonomous security robot manufacturer Cobalt Robotics, has been deployed to the Middle East 3 times as a Marine. He envisions Phantom as a next-generation multi-use apparatus with 8 cameras in its head and continuous payload capacity of 44 pounds that can reach as high as 80. The robot costs about $150,000 to manufacture in small volumes, a price that could could half that if production is scaled to thousands. This looks like, to me, the strongest multi-tool in the world, LeBlanc said. Every Marine has some kind of Leatherman, some kind of Swiss Army knife, something like that. That's exactly what this robot is. So whether you need to break into a door and have this go put some C4 explosive on that door so we don't have to send a Marine to do it, or if we have to send someone into a building first and provide cover outside the window, that no longer has to be a 19-year-old, that can now be a robot. The company of roughly 50 employees in a crowded robotics field with behemoths like OpenAI, Tesla, and 1X is now exploring phantom use cases with the U.S. Army, Air Force, Marine Corps, and the Department of Homeland Security, which could wield the robot to patrol U.S. borders, according to LeBlanc, who characterized those negotiations as ongoing and evolving. Everyone in the Department of Defense understands people have lots of approval processes, right? He said, testing that needs to go on. But they all want to do this in an expedited manner, so we're working with all the branches, and it's really a daily and weekly effort for us. The real work starts now. Foundation has secured roughly $10 million in government contracts, which are currently listed to Boardwalk Robotics, a Florida-based startup that created Alex, a humanoid upper torso intended to work in manufacturing, maintenance, and logistics, but not necessarily combat. Foundation acquired Boardwalk Robotics in December for an undisclosed amount and promptly added a lower torso, paving the way for Phantom MK1 to make its public debut as a DJ at a San Francisco nightclub in late January. Oh, that's hilarious. The company then shipped its first production model to a customer in May, just 13 months from idea to deployment, faster than any other humanoid company, Patek boasted on X. But the real work starts now, he added in the post. The next few months will be grueling as we work to have our deployed fleet perform full shifts. Most of our team's focus will be on this, so expect slower progress elsewhere. No humanoid company has achieved full shifts yet, making this a milestone worth pursuing. I'm excited for the progress and for the suffering ahead. Foundation is in the process of closing a fundraising round that has exceeded $100 million at a $1 billion pre-money valuation in coming weeks, and with follow-on demand at a $3.5 billion pre-money valuation, sources close to the matter told Newsweek. As warfare becomes increasingly reliant on long-range drones nearly 4 years after Russia invaded Ukraine, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced in July the U.S. military would bolster production and use of unmanned aircraft systems to maintain superiority on the modern battlefield. Drones are the biggest battlefield innovation in a generation, accounting for most of this year's casualties in Ukraine, Hegseth wrote in a July 10th memorandum. Our adversaries collectively produce millions of cheap drones each year. While global military drone production skyrocketed over the last 3 years, the previous administration deployed red tape. Sources at the DHS acknowledge informal conversations with Foundation reps as the company readies to supercharge production and build up to 10,000 Phantoms next year. But don't expect to see them patrolling entry points just yet. DHS currently does not have any official announcement for acquiring humanoid robots for use at the border, Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin told Newsweek in a statement. Under the Trump administration, our southern border is the most secure border in American history. Apprehensions are at an all-time low, and for the third consecutive month, Border Patrol released zero illegal aliens into the country, thanks to the brave men and women of Border Patrol. Thanks to the One Big Beautiful Bill, we are focused on hiring 3,000 new Border Patrol agents. Phantom's cross-country trek. The viability of humanoids like Phantom supplementing or replacing soldiers in real-life scenarios remains uncertain. In fact, a recent demonstration for Newsweek did not unfold as intended. The company's team put Phantom in an oversized plastic coffin and drove him more than 2,900 miles from San Francisco to Newsweek's global headquarters in Lower Manhattan, where he had to be rebuilt. Technicians, including one who abruptly flew in from Germany, feverishly worked over 2 days to get the newly retooled robot on its feet after several failed attempts. Phantom later stood unassisted for several moments, but collapsed while standing beside Patek, LeBlanc, and a startled reporter. The snafu was linked to an upgraded computer board installed just before arriving in New York, Patek said. The robot managed to interact with several employees while manning the front desk, startling some who expected to see a human. Wouldn't it be funny if you showed up at Newsweek and there was a robot at the front desk? Visualizing the robot outfitted with lethal components following its unexpected fall became difficult to fathom, but the company's commitment to perfect Phantom remained steady as Americans' rivals forge ahead with militarized machines. From the very beginning, we knew for a fact that we have to figure out a way to train these robots to use weapons, Patek told Newsweek. We didn't know what shape it was going to take. We didn't know what timeline it was going to be executed in. But at a very fundamental level, it is a necessary skill that they have to learn. As of today, you have China, Russia, and a bunch of U.S. adversaries already starting to weaponize robots, which has definitely expedited the timeline in our mind. Given other people are doing it, I think it is a pathological altruism to not do it yourself. If people think you're weak, they will believe it. Automation is taking over factories in China, which ranks third worldwide in industrial robot density, outpaced only by South Korea and Singapore, according to the International Federation of Robotics. The People's Liberation Army also unveiled a gun-mounted robot dog last year, manufactured by China's Unitree Robotics. In 2022, Russia demonstrated a modified Unitree robotics dog outfitted with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher at an arms fair in Moscow. Both nations are feverishly working to develop AI-powered autonomous weapons, defense analysts have previously told Newsweek. Roughly 10 Phantoms built this year are already being used by several clients, including an automaker in Atlanta and two consumer goods manufacturers, Patek said, adding Foundation plans to unveil a second-generation model with more power and simplified manufacturing next year. Between the Department of War and the current customers, we have our hands full, he wrote in an email following Foundation's visit. If we had 100,000 robots working today, we'll be able to place them at the customers that we currently have. At the Future Investment Initiative Summit in Saudi Arabia in October, Tesla CEO Elon Musk said he expects humanoid robots to outnumber the human population by 2040, with 10 billion in operation. That's 15 years, and we're going to have 10 billion humanoid robots? That really is Terminator, isn't it? Patek predicts thousands of humanoid robots will be deployed throughout the U.S. by Foundation and other companies within the next 12 to 18 months for very specific tasks, ultimately scaling to hundreds of thousands within 5 years. But 10 billion by 2040? Millions of machines like Phantom, performing a large variety of tasks, including defense-related applications, could occur within 10 years, he said, a timeline characterized as overly optimistic by other robotics experts. Meng-Yu Wang, director of the Harvard AI and Robotics Lab, said the near future for humanoid robots like Phantom look very promising, with varied uses in manufacturing, shipping, surveillance, domestic work, or even elderly care. Elderly care, really? What would that look like? But a seismic shift won't happen for a decade or longer. Many companies are building robots across the world, from Europe to Asia to the United States, of course, Wang told Newsweek. But if you're really familiar with those robots, they're not as intelligent as you have seen when you talk to ChatGPT. It's far from being there yet. Large language models that power AI chatbots have massive amounts of data that most robots simply do not currently possess. Exhaustive simulation training helps speed up the process before critical imitation learning takes place, he said. It's essentially a human trying to teach the robot to do something with fancy cameras or on-body sensors to track body movement, Wang said. And you show it, for instance, how to cook a dish. Real-world application outside of controlled environments then follows, and any robot is only as practical as the culled data ultimately used to optimize function, Wang said. That scarcity of intelligence makes most devices far from being useful in daily life, with many unexpected pitfalls, although robots could soon successfully be deployed on a wide scale to complete tasks like pumping gas or performing security screenings, he said. You can imagine, you want to simulate the physical world, and it's not that easy, Wang said. You need to get the physics right. You need to get the mechanics right. That's why big companies like NVIDIA are spending a lot of money to develop simulators. That's essentially infrastructure for robots. Most companies manufacturing robots don't have that data ready, Wang continued, and varying designs and control interfaces make collaboration among competitors unlikely, if not altogether impossible. Robot battery life is another major concern, he said. Their batteries kind of last 2 or 3 hours and then they need to be recharged, Wang said. In very controlled environments, that's probably fine. For instance, at gas stations, you can just have the robots go back to charging stations. But if you do it in the wild or on the road, where are you charging your robots? I mean, come on, we have enough trouble charging cars these days. Wang expects the promising future of humanoid robots to become fully realized within 10 years, with machines possibly loading dishwashers or folding clothes in millions of households. We're still far from the ChatGPT moment, but all companies are rushing in this area trying to make progress, Wang said. I still think that's probably a decade away. Fears of an android future. Ken Goldberg, who oversees robotics research at UC Berkeley and co-founded a company that focuses on high-volume supply chain technologies, acknowledged a lot of progress but called for managed expectations for humanoid robots both on and off the battlefield. I worry that the expectations are being raised unrealistically right now, Goldberg told Newsweek. There's a lot of things you have to be on guard against. To what degree are these robots being teleoperated? If there's a person behind the curtain, it's very deceptive. Robots trigger visceral reactions in most people, and feedback isn't always positive, especially among an American populace that's been raised on a heavy dose of science fiction, he said. Many people I talk with say, I'm very worried that I won't have a job in a few years because these robots are coming and they're going to steal my job, Goldberg said. This is an old fear, and it's bound up in a lot of fears about even immigrants. People worried about immigrants stealing their jobs. To me, it feels a lot like that wave of immigration fear that's being projected onto these new technologies. And the reality is that if you work in the technologies, you know that humans are so complex and sophisticated, I don't see much danger in them being replaced. Democratic Massachusetts Representative Jim McGovern, co-chair of the Congressional Robotics Caucus, that's a thing actually, told Newsweek, humanoid robots and AI automation shouldn't be used as an excuse to abandon workers and further deepen the inequality we see in our society. If companies choose to automate, they should be required to protect workers' jobs, wages, and dignity, and to share the massive wealth they generate with the folks on the factory floor, not just the C-suite executives and corporate shareholders. Ambi Robotics, which Goldberg helped launch in 2018, provides AI-powered robotic sorting and stacking for major shipping companies like Amazon, UPS, and FedEx. The company has sorted 100 million packages to date, but its AmbiStack system isn't aiming to displace warehouse workers, he said. They don't look like humanoids, and we don't pretend that they're going to take over, the robotics expert said. They're machines, and they're using AI. But startups like Foundation, in search of the next trillion-dollar idea for the Department of War or other federal agencies, should balance sensationalism with their ability to deliver amid a huge defense opportunity for robots, Goldberg said. Foundation's plan to weaponize humanoid robots plays into the classic sci-fi archetype, which can be helpful for fundraising and publicity, but seems very risky given the current reliability of these robots, he said. But in the future, I'd rather see a teleoperated robot going into a super hostile danger zone than a young human soldier. That makes sense, right? Ethics and security. Any ethical issues associated with militarized humanoid robots will likely overlap with those associated with existing drones and autonomous weapons systems, according to Michael Vermeer, a senior physical scientist at California-based think tank RAND. I don't foresee any new ethical issues that would arise just because of a humanoid form factor, and the Department of War has had an active policy on autonomy in weapon systems for many years now, Vermeer told Newsweek in an email. Security concerns are a different matter. Humanoid robots would be tightly embedded with ground-based forces, and cybersecurity and electronic warfare defenses would need to be carefully managed to ensure that the humanoid robots could not be deactivated or, worse, used against U.S. forces. Robots could also be used as tools to locate, surveil, and attack U.S. forces if cybersecurity vulnerabilities existed, Vermeer added. Patek, meanwhile, recognizes the monumental amount of work ahead of Foundation's engineering team before Phantom can potentially revolutionize daily life for civilians and soldiers alike. If your definition of wide deployment is millions of robots doing a large variety of tasks, that could take 10 years, Patek wrote Newsweek. But there is so much growth already ahead of us and other companies that I don't see that as an issue. Millions of robots within 10 years? What did Elon Musk say? You know, billions of robots within 15 years? All that sounds pretty pie in the sky, right? And as they showed when they brought the robot to Newsweek, he didn't work, you know. So, I mean, not that this isn't going to happen. I'm sure it will happen at some point, but it seems far-fetched to think we'll have millions of robots in the next 10 years. But, you know, who knows? Technology moves fast, and you got to keep up. And next is a story that I can relate to quite a bit. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for 30 years and have been going to AA and Al-Anon for most of that time. And this is a story about addiction and somebody who's doing something about it. King of Rehab's next mission. He overcame addiction and opened the country's most prestigious treatment center. Now, Richard Tate is taking on America's fentanyl crisis. Richard Tate, it's T-A-I-T-E, has lived enough lives for 10 men. Once a homeless addict who lost 25 years to drugs, he's now a multimillionaire entrepreneur determined to rebuild the recovery world from the ground up. Known as the King of Rehab, Tate, 59, is the founder of Cliffside Malibu, the luxury treatment center that became synonymous with celebrity recovery. After selling it for a record-breaking nine-figure sum in 2018, nine figures means hundreds of millions of dollars, Tate could have disappeared quietly into a comfortable Malibu retirement. Instead, he's back with two new treatment centers, a podcast, and a book, all fueled by purpose, faith, and his commitment to what he considers is unfinished business, America's fentanyl crisis. I lost 25 years of my life to drug addiction and have treated people for 22, Tate told Newsweek. That's 47 years. I'm the biggest miracle in history, and it's the best life I've ever known. Tate grew up in Encino, California, in a home that seemed idyllic from the outside, but that was not the case. You'd think it was a great childhood because we had enough, he said, but the beatings were really bad. Every day, all of us. When we weren't being beaten, we were being told, "What are you, stupid?" or "I wish you weren't born." By 17, his father had left, his family got evicted, and his beloved grandfather had died, all within 90 days. That was it. It broke me, he said. I spent the next 25 years killing myself with drugs and alcohol. Crack cocaine became his drug of choice. I'd smoke an ounce of cocaine every single day, no matter what, he said. It took me 3 years just to get 30 days sober. I probably had more sobriety dates than there are dates in the calendar. Ultimately, Tate's recovery came from years of trying and failing, from therapists who refused to give up on him, and from the people who believed he could change even when he didn't believe it himself. It took me 15 months of therapy before the light went on, he said, crediting Perspectives on Addiction author Margaret Fetting for setting him on the right path. Between therapy, Alcoholics Anonymous, and sober living, Tate finally got clean. I needed all of it, he said. Even before he was fully stable, Tate began helping others. He'd take newcomers from AA to breakfast, then for a haircut and new clothes, before dropping them off at a sober living facility, paying for their first 30 days himself. I always had more respect for your sobriety than mine, he said. That instinct eventually became his life's work. When Tate opened Cliffside Malibu in 2005, he had no experience in treatment administration, but he had lived experience in addiction. What started as a modest sober living home evolved into the country's most prestigious luxury rehab, attracting celebrities, executives, and elite clients seeking privacy and compassionate care. For years, Tate wrestled with the morality of making money from recovery. I couldn't get my head around making money off people being sick, he said. But then a Swami, Hindu religious teacher I met, told me, "Wouldn't the world be a better place if everyone could help people for a living?" He said it 3 years in a row before it finally sank in. The lesson released him from guilt and gave him a new compass. Once I understood that helping people could be my purpose and my profession, everything changed, Tate said. There's nothing to get, only to give. That's how I teach my kids and how I try to live. Once he embraced that truth, Cliffside flourished, eventually selling in 2018. But success didn't bring peace. Bound by a 5-year non-compete clause, Tate suddenly found himself adrift. I was living the aimless life of a Malibu housewife, he said. Oh, that's so sad, right? Completely depressed, watching the fentanyl crisis explode and feeling like I couldn't do anything. When the non-compete expired, Tate came back swinging. He launched Carrera Treatment Wellness and Spa, a next-generation facility he describes as the first ultra-luxury treatment and wellness experience. Think Four Seasons Hotel meets evidence-based recovery, he said. Every client has their own suite, their own temperature controls, and a juice bar downstairs. They get 40 hours of treatment and 3 mandatory spa sessions a week. You can literally be there for 30 days and not get the same spa treatment twice. While that might sound indulgent, for Tate, there's a proven rationale behind the prescribed luxury. I realize self-care turns into self-esteem, which turns into self-love, he explained. In all the years I've been treating people, I've never met anybody who truly loved themselves trying to kill themselves with drugs and alcohol. Leaving no one behind. At the same time, Tate began scaling a second brand, One Method Center, his most ambitious project yet. His mission is to treat 10,000 people in 2 years with a focus on veterans and the unhoused, the people most often left behind in conversations about recovery. A buddy of mine called and said his treatment center was about to miss payroll, Tate recalled. It was called One Method. I walked in and bought it in 3 hours. That's how I do due diligence. Within days, he called 10 of his best former Cliffside employees and told them, "Sorry for the late notice, but everybody comes home today." 10 people quit their jobs on the spot to join the cause, and 24 more followed. I realized One Method could be the bridge between the ultra-luxury world and the people who have nothing, he said. I came back to treat the military, he said. I'm pulling veterans right off the street and putting them in treatment. They're the easiest to treat, self-starters, soldiers. We're scaling this to 1,000 beds so we can treat veterans, their spouses, and their kids. Tate has been personally underwriting much of the effort. I sold my last business for 9 figures, no debt and no partners, he said. I can do anything I want, and what I want is to help people. His urgency stems from a crisis he calls the deadliest epidemic in American history. The fentanyl issue is worse than anything we've ever seen, Tate said. It kills 100,000 people a year, probably more, because if someone dies in a car accident with fentanyl in their system, it's marked as a car accident. People don't realize how bad it is. As well as walking the walk, Tate's talking the talk with his podcast, We're Out of Time, which started as a platform to raise awareness about fentanyl, but has since evolved into a hub for conversations about recovery, mental health, and resilience. In less than a year, it's become a breakout hit, peaking at number 1 in mental health and number 20 overall on Apple Podcasts. His most memorable guest, the rapper Zan Man, who broke down in tears mid-episode. I talked him into treatment right on the show, Tate said. It was the most beautiful moment I've had. Tate has treated everybody from billionaires and royalty to people living on the street, and he's seen how both privilege and poverty can complicate recovery. Fame and wealth don't make recovery easier, he said. It's harder because of the enablers, the agents, the managers, the lawyers, the assistants. These people don't make money unless their clients are working, so they keep pushing them back out before they're ready. They ruin a good thing. Yet, he says, most high-profile clients surprise him. Almost without exception, the more famous or wealthy someone is, the nicer they are, he told me. They have humility and gratitude. It's the ones pretending who are miserable. Now 20-plus years sober, Tate's life runs on discipline and devotion. He wakes up between 3:30 and 4 a.m. for quiet reflection before the day begins. He prays constantly, meditates to center his mind, eats simply, works out daily, and sees his therapist 3 times a week. My connection to God is the only thing that's ever worked for me, he said. Even when I was using, my prayers were, God, I know I'm a disappointment. Please keep me safe. No hospitals, no cops. I'll start again when this run is over. Tate is open about the trauma that drove his addiction and how healing it requires reparenting the child he once was. There are no bad five-year-olds, he said, but if you're constantly beaten by the people who are supposed to love you, you think you're bad. Pretty soon, you've got a 45-year-old man being run by a five-year-old. Therapy helped me see the truth. I was perfect just the way I was. My legacy is to make certain my children are okay in the world when I'm gone, he added. That they understand their station in life comes with responsibility and that they leave this place better than they found it. Tate's new book, Experiencing Transcendence, The Freedom of Recovering from Addiction and Trauma, October 2025, published by Wheatmark, co-authored with addiction researcher Constance Scharf, expands on that philosophy. This isn't a death sentence, he said. It's a speed bump. Sobriety isn't its own gift. You have to have an equal or better life in recovery. If you can help people joyfully with the heart of a servant, it always works. That's a great article and a man who is doing great things for others. That is Richard Tate, the king of rehab, and you can find his podcast on wherever podcasts are sold, like Apple and other places. And he's got a new book that's out, Experiencing Transcendence. And again, it's Richard Tate, T-A-I-T-E, the king of rehab. Next is a story from the television about an actor that you know from a very, very successful show. And he is playing a villain in a new show on Netflix called Death by Lightning, about the assassination of Andrew Garfield. And I'm watching this right now, and I really, really enjoy it. I'm always been a bit of a assassination buff, although that sounds weird, with the various presidents who've been killed and, you know, Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and others. But this is a very interesting story that none of us know about. The story is called Struck from History. Matthew McFadden talks exclusively to Newsweek about bringing a forgotten chapter of America's past to life in Netflix's Death by Lightning. Over 2 years after his final turn as Succession's calculating yet quirky Tom Wamsgans, Matthew McFadden returned to the World Trade Center complex, the backdrop for Waystar Roy Coe's headquarters on the show. This time, instead of heading to television network ATN, he joined Newsweek to discuss his latest role, playing Charles Guiteau, U.S. President James A. Garfield's assassin, in Netflix limited series Death by Lightning. With his long beard, erratic persona, and chronic money troubles, Guiteau is much less polished than Succession's Wamsgans, the buttoned-up business executive. But despite being separated by over a century and a half, the two characters share a similar through line. Wesley, outsiders clawing for status and attention in an environment dominated by politics and money, a sharp contrast from the reserved British actor who plays them. It's tremendously liberating to do these sorts of parts because it's so far away from me, McFadden, 51, told Newsweek. In fact, he continued, it's liberating to play an American only because of the rhythms of speech. It gives you a sort of confidence. It's very attractive. He added, as a Brit to play that, it's great. Thrilling, because I'm not like that in real life. Mike Makowski's historical drama, Death by Lightning, which premiered on November 6th on Netflix, is a four-part limited series adapted from Candace Millard's nonfiction bestseller, Destiny of the Republic. McFadden stars alongside Michael Shannon, Nick Offerman, Betty Gilpin, and Shea Whigham. Its release felt eerily timely. Filming began just days before then-Republican nominee Donald Trump was shot at a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, last July, the bullet grazing his ear inches from killing the soon-to-be president. It was unsettling and surreal, McFadden said. It makes you alive to the fact that you're making something worthwhile, even though you know it's timely and timeless. It reinforces that. 2 months later, in September, a suspected assassination attempt was thwarted when Secret Service agents spotted an armed suspect near the Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida, and opened fire. Trump was unharmed, and the suspect was later arrested. The tale of Guiteau is not nearly as vivid, and despite being an important part of American history, many remain unaware of the assassination of 20th President Garfield, portrayed by Shannon in the series. A forgotten history. Wedged between the Civil War and World War I, the story of a Republican president struck by a bullet from a man who knew him has strangely slipped from America's collective memory. I didn't know anything about this history, McFadden admitted, joining the many now catching up to Garfield's expedited path to power, the political ongoings of the Gilded Age, and most notably, his assassination. Garfield, prior to his assassination, stood out as a true statesman against the spoils of politics, a leader McFadden described as fundamentally decent, adding, "It really struck me what a waste," and made him consider what might have been had Guiteau not shot Garfield just 4 months into his presidency. The trusting, thorough reformer sought to bridge partisan divides and meet with constituents, a move that ended up taking his life. McFadden's character is a restless, untethered soul struggling with mental health illnesses. Guiteau flits through failed jobs in every corner of the economy and never quite lands anywhere that offers him stability, notably having been booted from a love commune. Viewers see Garfield's demise beginning as Guiteau, who McFadden described as a deranged man from the Midwest, become fixated on an ambassadorship from the president. After being denied the political appointment in Garfield's administration, which Guiteau wholeheartedly believed he was entitled to, he purchased a revolver and on July 2, 1881, shot President Garfield twice at a train station in Washington, D.C. He maintained his act was for the good of the party and country, finding himself to be a hero. In a poem written in custody, Guiteau wrote, "'Twas God's will, not mine, that he should die. I executed the divine command, and Garfield did remove to save my party and my country from the bitter fate of war." Guiteau had campaigned for Garfield, albeit on the outskirts, which included stumping for him in front of a small gathering. He genuinely believed he was key in electing Garfield, McFadden said. The at times erratic and deluded Guiteau, who saw himself as friends with Garfield and Chester Arthur, the New York port customs collector turned vice president, was not entirely irrational, McFadden noted, adding, "I felt quite sympathetic toward him." Garfield died 11 weeks after the bullets, thrusting Arthur into the nation's highest office. As the story traces Garfield's unconventional rise, past party machinery and backroom deals, McFadden quipped that nothing seems to have changed in the U.S. political system despite the century-plus gap with the infighting in Washington. He added that the story made him reflect on the fragility of American institutions and serves as a reminder that the nation is still young. Craft and the character. That same sense of observation shapes how McFadden approaches his craft. His ability to step outside the chaos of his characters may be what allows him to move so fluidly between eras and extremes, from Guiteau's madness to Succession's calculating whamsgans. The two-time Emmy winner started out in theater, then made his first major screen appearance in 1998's Wuthering Heights. He later became a household name in British spy series Spooks, and in 2005, his stardom went global with his portrayal of Mr. Darcy alongside Keira Knightley in Joe Wright's movie adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. Roles that followed included playing an inspector in TV series Ripper Street and intelligence officer Charles Colomandoli in the film Operation Mincemeat. But it was only later down the line that McFadden registered similarities between roles, he said. The boring truth is that as an actor, you're just careering from job to job to job, and later you go, oh, there's a line between these characters. Asked if he saw the coherence looking back, he said, yes, a little bit, before joking, maybe it's time I do something else. Unrestrained on camera, the actor is notably reserved offset. Even after playing particularly high-intensity personalities, he makes a point of not bringing his characters home, saying he simply doesn't understand actors who do that. It doesn't make any sense, he said. Method acting often blurs the lines between the personal and performative as actors fully immerse themselves in their characters. The technique was a topic of debate among Succession's cast members as Jeremy Strong, who played Kendall Roy, was unable to leave the almost CEO son on set. Strong described his character work as Kendall in the most serious terms, telling The New Yorker, "To me, the stakes are life and death, adding that he takes playing Kendall as seriously as I take my own life. His dedication and inability to unwrap from his dark, desperate, and power-hungry character caused a rift on set, with Brian Cox, who played the Roy Patriarch Logan, telling The Guardian that Strong's method was not good for the ensemble because it creates hostility. In another interview with Variety, he doubled down on his stance to do the job by playing the role and don't identify. McFadden argued actors have a responsibility to leave their character behind, explaining to Newsweek there's a certain discipline about you're on and you're off, calling it unprofessional to blur the lines. True to that, he and Nicholas Braun, who played Greg Hirsch, enjoyed an easy rapport off the set of Succession, even as on screen, their character's bond was wry, lopsided, and transactional. I miss him, he said of his sidekick Braun. Away from the screen, the actor has been keen to guard his home life. He lives in the UK with his wife, actress Keeley Hawes, and two children, and inevitably spends time away from home while working, a practice he admits can be challenging to balance. In the digital age, he sometimes, especially during press runs, swaps his smartphone for the light phone, a minimalist no-browser device that doesn't let him become engrossed in the reviews and noise on social media around his roles, he told Newsweek. When I'm not working, sometimes I struggle with watching TV and film, weirdly, he said, adding that it would be like what the British call a busman's holiday. Yet even so, he manages to unwind with his wife, admitting he's recently been sucked into The Celebrity Traitors, the BBC reality hit where stars test loyalties and betrayals inside a Scottish castle. And recently, McFadden entered into a world of even darker loyalties and betrayals, voicing Lord Voldemort in the full cast audiobook adaptation of the Harry Potter series produced by Audible. He described his first voiceover experience as a challenge that was good fun, despite being alone in a studio for 8 hours, just with yourself and a wand. So, in my opinion, if you have not had a chance to watch Netflix's Death by Lightning, I highly recommend it. It's pretty short. It's only 4 episodes, but it shines a light on Andrew Garfield and this man, Charles Guiteau, and a very little-known time in history where Garfield was assassinated and how he became president and what happened afterwards. I enjoyed it a lot. So please take a chance and watch Netflix Death by Lightning. The rest of us, our stories for this week come to us from Game and Fish magazine for December for the Midwest. And they regularly, I think quarterly, they list the things that are out there right now in the Midwest that are good hunting or good fishing. So we'll start with that. Around the Midwest, with December comes winter. For some, this means the end of another year outdoors. For others, winter offers spectacular fishing, hunting, and trapping, especially if you like solitude. As snow piles up along fences, lakes ice up, and flocks of geese push south, hunters and anglers can enjoy a season worth celebrating. Hunters can tag a few more deer, chase winter rabbits, or spend another morning in a blind waiting for birds. Anglers hit the ice or enjoy open waters devoid of crowds. Trout folks wait for warm afternoons when ice won't freeze, freeze rod guides, and little bugs hatch. Across the region, options abound for those willing to embrace the cold. Whether it's pulling crappies through the ice, slipping through cover for rabbits, or watching your breath rise on a frozen riverbank, winter reminds us the outdoors is always open. First, we're going to go to Missouri. Mark Twain crappies. Open water crappie fishing can be great in December on Missouri's Mark Twain Lake. Fish move into deeper water and hold around brush piles, standing timber, and creek channels, and this lake is full of all three. Good electronics are key to find the brush piles, but once you do, you might not have to move again. Jig vertically with small jigs tipped with minnows or soft plastics, or use slip bobber rigs with minnows. The daily limit is 15 crappies with no minimum length requirement. Boat ramps on the north, south, and middle fork arms provide access. That was Mark Twain crappies in Missouri. Number two from Wisconsin. Wisconsin Canada geese. Wisconsin's Canada Goose season has North and South zones. The North Zone closes December 16th, while the South Zone closes December 7th, but it reopens December 20th through January 2nd. In East Central Wisconsin, the 10,900-acre Horicon Marsh State Wildlife Area lies beside the 20,924-acre Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, forming the nation's largest freshwater cattail marsh. I mean, that's 32,000 acres of land that you can hunt. Managed by the Wisconsin DNR, the state area is open to hunting and widely recognized for its Canada goose population. Hunters must carry a small game license, HIP certification, state migratory bird stamp, Canada goose permit, and a federal duck stamp. The daily bag limit is 3 Canadian geese. Number 3 is Minnesota. Minnesota deer. As chronic wasting disease continues to spread through wild deer, Minnesota's DNR has new rules and hunting opportunities to lower deer populations in key areas and reduce the disease's impact. In 2025, CWD hunts occur in units 605, 642, 643, 645, 646, 647, 648, 649, and from December 19th to 21st. So it's a narrow hunt in certain areas. The bag limit for this hunt is 5 deer of either sex, so you can get a bunch of them. Hunters must submit tissue samples from deer taken during the special CWD hunts and in surveillance zones. Here is one from South Dakota. Sheridan Lake ice action. Found 15 miles west of Rapid City in South Dakota's Black Hills National Forest, 375-acre Sheridan Lake is a pretty place to ice fish, especially when snow covers the hills. Rainbow trout, panfish, pike, and largemouth all dwell here. Fish small jigs tipped with minnows or bemoths over submerged structure near points and on drop-offs. For pike, use tip-ups. Carry a valid South Dakota fishing license and always check the ice for safety. Number 5. In Illinois archery deer. Hunters can still add to their freezers during Illinois' late archery season, which runs through January 18th, 2026. That's a pretty long season. With the rut over, bucks worn down from chasing does now look for food, making them vulnerable near feeding areas. Cold winter days make long sits difficult, but it's a great time to crossbow hunt from a blind. 10 Mile Creek State Fish and Wildlife Area spans nearly 5,000 acres across 4 tracks and is a good public land option in southern Illinois. So this is right across the river in Illinois from St. Louis. So check that out. Number 6, this is from Indiana. Willow Slough Rabbits. Slough, I guess it is. Indiana's Willow Slough Fish and Wildlife Area in Newton County spans nearly 10,000 acres of wetlands, grasslands, and woodlands, great habitat for rabbits. The slough is a popular spot for hunters, but there's less competition these days for chasing rabbits. Hunters must check in daily and follow all property-specific and statewide regulations. Good cover exists along brushy fence rows running through agricultural fields, and rabbits are also found in transitional habitat between woods and open fields. Hunters with beagles or any sort of flushing dog have a big advantage. And our final state is Kansas. Kansas stocked trout, number 7. Each winter, the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks stocks trout in select lakes, ponds, and streams to provide opportunities to target these popular non-native species. The season runs from December 1st through March 31st. Anglers need a valid fishing license and a trout permit, and the limit is 5 trout per day with a possession limit of 15. A few top stocked waters include Willow Lake at Tuttle Creek State Park, Webster Reservoir Stilling Basin, and Lake Henry at Clinton State Park. However, more than 30 waters statewide participate, bringing trout fishing to anglers far from mountain streams. Visit the KDWP website for the complete list. That's Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks. So again, we've got 7 different hunting and fishing opportunities here in the Midwest. Again, there's Mark Twain crappies in Missouri, Wisconsin Canada geese, Minnesota deer, Sheridan Lake ice action in South Dakota, Illinois archery deer, and that's down here in southern Illinois, number 6, Willow Slough rabbits in Indiana, and finally, Kansas stocked trout. So there's lots of opportunities for you to get a late season, late winter season opportunity to be out there hunting and fishing, and probably not a lot of people around you. So that's a good idea. Here's a great story for those of us wanting to go down memory lane. Now that it's Thanksgiving and Christmas is coming and the holidays are here and we're thinking about family and traditions, this is a column called Rites by Jeff Johnston. The gift of self-sufficiency. Sometimes the best Christmas present is the one you don't get. It was mid-November when Shane handed his Christmas wish list to his mother. It was ambitious, but in line with the wishes of a 16-year-old boy. Right at the top was a Remington Model 700 BDL in 308 with a 3x9x40mm scope. A few days later, when word spread to Shane's father, he breached the topic with his only son. "Shane, I saw your Christmas list." Shane ceased eating his breakfast and looked up at full attention. "That's a great rifle, and you know I'd love to get you one," started Shane's dad. "But with the new roof and your mother's car blowing the transmission this year, I'm afraid we just can't swing it right now. I'm sorry, son, but don't worry. We'll still have a great Christmas just like we always do." Shane didn't say a word, not knowing whether this was a form of deception on his father's part or if his words were true. In the past, he'd always received what he asked for, although nothing to date had been as lavish as a scoped hunting rifle. Even so, Shane felt pretty good about his chances. Christmas morning finally arrived, and after the gifts from family and friends were opened, Shane's father walked out of the den, donned his Santa's cap, and re-entered the room with an armful of presents for Shane and his sister. Shane noticed immediately that none of the boxes in his arms could possibly hold a rifle, but Shane held out hope. Over the years, he'd learned that old Santa could be sneaky. Shane opened his pile of presents that culminated with a small, weighty box that turned out to be a top-of-the-line Abu Garcia bait casting reel. He was thrilled. "I love it," Shane said as he pushed the silvery button on the red reel's frame and then cranked the handle as fast as he could. "So smooth." "Yeah, that thing has 5 ball bearings," quipped his father. "Cool," said Shane as he thumbed the spool. "Welp," announced Shane's father after finishing his coffee in his easy chair. "I hope everyone had a great Christmas. I know I did. Thank you for all the gifts. I love you all so much. Now I'm going to start carving the ham. Company will be here in an hour." "Love you all too," said Shane, who suddenly felt guilty for being disappointed despite all his great gifts. He was old enough to realize that many people didn't get anything for Christmas. At that moment, though, Shane became more determined than ever to own that Remington, so he put his mind to figuring out how he could buy one himself. It was early June when Shane came home late from school. He was carrying a rifle case and wearing a giant smile as he walked through the door and passed his mother on his way up the stairs. "What's that?" she asked. "My rifle," said Shane. "Oh," said his mother, letting Shane go upstairs without further questioning. A couple hours later, Shane's father found his son in the garage. On the workbench before him was a Remington 700 BDL. "What's that?" asked his father. "My rifle," said Shane. "Okay, but where'd you get it?" "Dave's pawn," said Shane. "Well, it isn't mine yet, but it will be if you'll go down there and sign off on it. You know how I've been doing some odd jobs for Dave since January? He said he'd trade me this rifle instead of paying me cash. He told me to work on it tonight as his employee, said it needed a new butt pad, a sling stud, and a good cleaning, and then run it by you to make sure it's okay. The deal is fine by me, but does it shoot?" asked Shane's father. "Well, Dave said it's a tack driver, but he also said I could shoot it first to see for myself." "Is it a 308? "Yep," said Shane. "That's wonderful, son," said his father. "You don't know how proud I am. I'll run us down to Dave's tomorrow and we'll make it official." "Great," said Shane. "But I've got one small problem." "Uh-oh," said his father. "What's that, son?" "Dave was out of hunting ammo, so I went to the hardware store to look for some. I had no idea that stuff was so expensive. So now I've got a rifle, but no cartridges for it." "Well, son," said his father, chuckling, "I believe old Santa might be able to swing an early Christmas present this year." That's a great story of self-sufficiency, right? You don't get what you want for Christmas, but you're able to figure out how to get it on your own. And as a father and a grandfather wouldn't make me any more prouder to see my kid or my grandkid do something like that. So I'm sure that brings back lots of memories from your childhood or watching your children or grandchildren on Christmas morning. It's an amazing thing. The Late Show. As temps plummet and deer become more wary, it's time to rethink your setup. Late season bow hunting is an entirely different game compared to early season archery forays. The deer are jumpy after weeks of bullets slinging around them, cover is greatly reduced, and the air is bitter. Everything is a touch more difficult for deer and bow hunters alike in the depths of winter. Most hunters reconsider their apparel choices and stand setups when the mercury drops, but few think about one of the most overlooked adjustments you can make for success when the snow flies: changing your bow setup for cold weather. The late season isn't just about endurance, it's about adaptation, and that starts with your gear, the grip and gloves. The first thing to address is your grip. I wear thin brown jersey gloves throughout most of October and November. When December and January arrive, the big gloves come out. Thick gloves and trigger releases rarely get along. You either can't feel the trigger or you feel it too soon. For that reason, I shift to a hand muff and a thin glove system once temperatures dip. My release hand stays tucked inside a muff with a chemical warmer until it's time to shoot. If you prefer to wear thick gloves, you must practice with them. You'll quickly find out if your anchor point changes or your trigger control suffers. If it does, don't try to fight through it. Either switch releases or change your gloves. Draw weight. Pride versus practicality. Many bow hunters like to announce how much poundage their bow is set at, but there's no metal for struggling through a draw cycle when you're half frozen and wearing three layers. Cold muscles simply don't work the same as warm ones. If you can't draw your bow smoothly and quietly in a tree stand with stiff shoulders and a puffy jacket, your draw weight is too high. For me, dropping 5 to 10 pounds in draw weight for late season has zero downside. Modern bows are efficient. At 60 pounds with a heavy arrow, you'll still punch through both lungs at 25 yards. Plus, you'll draw smoother, aim steadier, and stay quieter. All critical advantages when the deer are spooky and the air is still. There's a mental hurdle for many hunters here. They think drawing lower weight somehow makes them less of a hunter. Forget that nonsense. Late season bow hunting isn't a test of strength, it's a test of control. Mindset and muscle memory. Finally, remember this. Your bow setup isn't just about hardware. It's about how you perform when you're freezing. The late season demands patience and discipline, not adrenaline. Every adjustment you make to your setup should have one goal: to make your shot process effortless under the worst conditions. When that heavy-bodied buck finally steps into the corn stubble or edges out from the timber to feed, you won't have time to think about whether your glove will catch the string. You'll just draw, settle, and release like you do under normal circumstances. That's the reward for preparation. The bottom line: changing your bow setup for cold weather isn't a sign of weakness, it's a mark of experience. Late season bow hunting can be surprisingly good in the right situation, but it will almost certainly be cold and the deer will be anything but dumb. You can't just grit your teeth and hope. You need to adapt. That's good advice just for everyday living, right? We just need to adapt to what's going on around us and be aware of it and make changes so that whatever we're doing becomes a little easier and more efficient. So some good advice for late season hunting. Well, we are out of time, and I hope you have had a happy Thanksgiving and a great weekend with family and friends. And we will bring this to you again next Friday. Please listen to all the great programming available to you right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care, everybody, and happy holiday.